else that we need to do that I'm missing? Okay. We'd like to go around the room and have you each introduce yourself and tell us what your audio affiliation is. That's always a fascinating thing. So if we'll start here and go this way. Go ahead.
I'm Paul Shaw. I'm one of Steve's students.
Great. Thank you.
I'm Andy High. I'm a student here in Sheldon.
Great.
Mark Rogers. I'm a consultant in audio and video.
Dave Tosselin, I'm in the Performance Production Department at Cornish College of the Arts.
Steve Turnage, Vice Chair of the Local Committee, Mastering Engineer, Circuit Board Designer, and founded WeChip.
Janie Wallach, live audio archivist and general enthusiast.
Rick Chin, Section Webmaster. Owner, chief cook, bottle washer, do you need audio? We do all things audio and no things video.
Tom Walker, I'm with Audio Control.
Brady Moore, I was an engineer of audio industry for quite a time.
Dave Francois, I'm the treasurer of the section, musician, and I'm a technical writer at Mackie.
Hello, I'm James. I'm an audio student at the Art Institute.
Hello, I'm Oliver Stelfox, and I'm also a student at the Art Institute.
I'm Steve Malata, teacher at Shoreline.
Tom Archer, I'm trying to get a small label, GSL Records, going.
I'm Mike Nadek, engineer at Studio 5 Recording in Belgium.
Phil Nicolay, I provide tech support, freelance tech support service to all the studios and so forth.
I'm George Thomas, I'm a programmer with civil engineering at the University of Washington.
I'm Cody Groom, I'm the studio manager here at Shoreline.
I'm Peter Hill, I'm a software engineer at Cisco.
I'm Jacqueline Schumann, I'm a sound designer for Firewall Software.
I'm Nate Fulcher.
I'm Matt Fordham, and I'm an instructor here at Shoreline.
I'm Nir Stott, I'm a student. Bob Gudgel, techno weenie, lived worked for several of the old audio companies around town. Now I'm designing for alternative energy companies, and I'm on the committee. That's my audio leak these days to keep my sanity.
Nick Klein, I do tech support for an alternative energy company, and have a home studio that I work with.
Rick Smargas, I'm a small company called Integrated Light and Sound, and I work at Sound and Video Commission at Seattle Center.
I'm Gary Louie. I'm the secretary of the Audio Engineering Society, Pacific Northwest section, and I work at the University of Washington School of Music, doing the recordings.
Yeah, I'm a student here.
Okay, great. Welcome.
Should we have Jack introduce himself?
No, I'll have you introduce him. But first, our website is over there on the wall there. If you want to know about our activities, go there. If you want to become a member of the Audio Engineering Society, there are several categories you could be. You can find that at aes.org. You don't have to be a member to come to these meetings, but we encourage you to do that because that's how we get the money to put these on, is from our national organization. And in furtherance of that, we need to ask how many are AES members. Just raise your hand so Gary can count.
9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16.
We use this to, they want to know what percentage of the people who come to these meetings are members. So if it was 1% who come to the meetings, that would be an indicator that we need to do something different. These meetings happen because somebody on the committee gets an idea of a meeting to do, and they go to the work to put it together. And tonight, the person who did that is Steve Turnage, and I'm having him introduce our guest.
Greetings. Hi, I'm Steve. And this is Jack. You know, Jack and Dino. We're about the same height. But Jack and I have been hanging out lately. We're in the same band together now. And I've been admiring his work from afar and wanting to be able to share it out with the general public here. He was just here about a month ago, where a little interview was happening, and that was sort of light and fluffy. I said, well, I'd like to see something really sort of deep and sticky, you know, as compared. And so I told Jack not to hold back at all, and this will be if you don't know what he's talking about, then it defines some place you can learn, which is great. Something that doesn't happen enough, because a lot of times when people talk down to an audience, they talk too low, and you go, okay, well, that was great. So hopefully Jack can... Any questions? I'm sure you'll be open to questions as it goes through.
Of course, of course. Fabulous.
And
of
you're obviously...
I'm live right
now. You're live. Yeah. Good. So without further ado, Mr. Giacondino.
Well, thanks to the AES guys for getting me in here. I'll try not to geek out too much, but I might... well, we'll see. Most of you here probably have some idea of why you've actually even heard of me, which is that I've been doing indie rock records for about 20 years now. My first real gig as a recording engineer was at Reciprocal Recording in 1986. And we had an 8-track analog machine, and I got really good with razor blades for editing and so forth. And it's been sort of a long, strange trip ever since then, because I think the very first... I'll just recap a few things I probably covered last time I was here. I think almost the very first clients I had in the studio were my friends in a band called Soundgarden, and I did their very first record on the Otari 8-track machine. We spent an enormous amount of time mixing it. It's, you know, I was still learning how to record. Not long after that, I started doing other bands. The Sub Pop label came into existence and started putting records out by these bands. And by default, I sort of became known as the guy who records all the Sub Pop records, even though I was independent and it really had nothing to do with them. One of the first full albums that I recorded for the Sub Pop label was the first Nirvana record, Bleach, which we did right around Christmas time in 1988. I was literally in the studio with the guys Christmas Eve, I think, even... that record took a total of about 30 hours of studio time and has sold a, you know, a zillion billion copies. And I made about $160 on it. But my name is on every copy of it. So, you know, that's all right. I have a career. The sort of grunge explosion that we're all probably very sick of hearing about, maybe you guys aren't as sick of hearing about it as I am, every anniversary of somebody ODing or dying or a big record coming out, the journalists all have me on their, you know, their call list. You know, would you like to say something about, you know, the 10-year anniversary of when Nevermind was released, or, oh, you know, Soundgarden broke up 5 years ago, I'm doing a story. And now I've got the kids doing term papers, and even college students doing theses on grunge. There has been more than one of those. And, you know, I wish them luck, and I have to be gracious about it, and I talk to them. We've got to be a nice guy. But let's just say my website, endino.com, has a very big frequently asked questions section, which I'm continually adding to, because people tend to ask the same interview questions over and over, even though, well, I don't know, the books, the magazine articles. Anyway, enough about that. I wound up with a very strange career in indie rock, you might say. After the Nirvana's next album wound up knocking Michael Jackson off the charts, I got a lot of job offers from a lot of strange places, and frankly, a lot of really bad music. A lot of people wanted to sound like a Seattle band and wanted to jump on the gravy train and get signed, and I'll get Jack to work on our record. Among other things, at one point in, I think it was 1995, 96, I actually got a call from the band Bush, who were this terrible English band who really wanted to sound like a Seattle band. They were god-awful, terrible band. And they were coming through Seattle, and they wanted to stop on their tour for just a couple days and record a couple songs with Jack and Dino. And fortunately, I was getting married and going on my honeymoon at that time, so I had an excuse to not do it. But there were a lot of more interesting things that came along. One of them was I got a call in 1993 from a Brazilian band. Of course, I didn't know anything about Brazil or Brazilian rock or anything. I got a call from a band in 1993 via someone at Warner Brothers International, a band called the Titans, or Os Titãs. And I come to find out that they're a huge band in Brazil, and they love the stuff that's coming out of Seattle. And they call me, and they're talking to me, and they're broken English. They say, Jack, nobody here in Brazil can record rock bands. Nobody here knows how to record a guitar properly, you know. And so in 1993, I find myself in São Paulo, Brazil, working with this band, who I realize they're like the U2 of Brazil. They're huge. And so I have, you know, nice hotels, food, excellent studios, the whole thing. And wound up making this band's... This was a band that had spent years in Brazil. They had started in 84. And I think I was making their 7th or 8th album at that point. And all their previous records had been sort of victimized by Brazilian pop producers who did things like sampling everything, you know, okay, record the drummer, okay, you can go home now, we've got enough of your drums, and, you know, chopping it all up and looping it and doing the crazy things that people did in the 80s to make rock records. And the band just wanted to make an actual rock album with the Marshall amps turned up and actually having the guitars be present in the mix, and I obliged them, and the record company was horrified, but the band's fans loved it. So I was golden from then on. So this band, the Titans, has gotten me down to Brazil. I think I've made 5 albums for them now. The last one was in 2005. And it's strange. I wind up with a hotel on the beach in Rio sometimes. Studios that are much huger than what I would usually see here in Seattle. And some very interesting experiences. And I will start, instead of telling you grunge stories, I will tell you about what I did over my summer in 2005, which was a very interesting experience, and I will demonstrate some things. I got a phone call from the drummer, Charles, of Titans. He says, Jack, we want you to come down and make another record for us, but it's this very strange, it's a specific project. We want to make a live DVD. And I said, well, okay, you know, you mean surround mixes? He said, yeah, surround mixing, stereo mix, there'll be a CD and there'll be a DVD, and you'll mix it twice, once in stereo, once in surround. I said, well, Charles, I've never done surround. I don't know anything about it. And he says, well, don't worry about it. You'll do fine. he says, audience in the back, a little bit of vocals in the center channel. You'll have fun with it. It's no problem, you know. We have all confidence in you. It'll be no problem. So I said, okay, you know. So I did a little quick research. So I was launched into this project with this band. Now, their plan was to make... I'll backtrack for a minute. Brazil is an interesting country in that the record market is shrinking dramatically. In fact, it's shrinking so dramatically that they recently changed the benchmark for gold and platinum records. In Brazil, it used to be a platinum record was 250,000 sales and a gold record was 100,000. And now... A platinum record in Brazil is 100,000, and I don't remember what a gold record is. It's probably 50 or 25 or something like that. So the record market is becoming almost Canada-sized in terms of their benchmarks for gold and platinum records. And I have 3 gold and 2 platinum records in Brazil, which, by the way, do absolutely nothing for my career in the United States. It's like I went to Mars and made a record. Nobody has any idea here that I've even worked with this band. The records are in Portuguese. You can't buy them here. It's just one of those strange things. So they say, okay, Jack, their idea was, oh, backtracking again, the Brazilian record market now, all the record labels in Brazil, the major labels, are very concentrated on making DVDs. And the reason is because they're not being pirated. The Brazilian CD market is about 70% pirates, which means literally guys selling CDRs on blankets on the street corners everywhere you go. And the... You know, they're too busy chasing drug gangs to worry about enforcing copyright actions against these pirates. So the CD market has been completely destroyed by piracy in Brazil. So bands are releasing live, so-called live DVDs instead. And they'll have a show and they'll play a bunch of new songs at the live show, debut them there, record them, and that's the record. So what they decided to do was record a special concert, an outdoor show, and they were going to do it on the southern coast of Brazil on an island called Florianópolis in front of a 300-year-old Portuguese fortress on the coast. which is an old stone structure. I'll have a picture of it that I can show you here. The first thing I thought was, well, what kind of electricity does this have? And that was only one of many issues that we ended up dealing with. Let me show you a picture of what it ended up looking like. Hopefully QuickTime or something will open when I click on this JPEG, and we'll see. There we go. That's a picture of the fortress, or Fortaleza, as they say. And this is scanned from a Brazilian, the Brazilian MTV magazine. Now, the, when these, the MTV Brazil is very powerful in the Brazilian record market. They partner with the major labels for almost all of these things because MTV Brazil takes care of the video content and the record company takes care of the audio content. And my job was to produce the audio content for this DVD while MTV was filming the event with 8 cameras. And let me go to a bigger picture. There it is. That's the 2 pages there. Now, if you look, this is the stage. It has a Titas logo on it. Here are some lighting rigs. You can't quite see it, but somewhere here is an actual boom with a camera on it that is very tall. This is the Fortaleza, and you can't see it, but way over here on the side, off on the left, was a little metal shack propped up on a hillside with bricks, very precariously. In fact, the floor sort of sloped, and that was where the my little control room was set up. There was an AMEC board, a couple of Mackie speakers, a video monitor, so I could sort of, which the MTV people sent me a feed of from some of their cameras. Now, the MTV people were down under this corner of the castle was a dungeon. There was literally an old stone room right under this little corner, and that's where the MTV people had all of their video equipment. And there were hundreds of people doing this, which, again, I was reminded how big this band is. And people would come up to me and congratulate me on this amazing thing that they were doing as though I was responsible for it in some way, because I was the producer. Only of the audio, though. So, oh dear, this story has so many amusing aspects to it.
Is that about 200 people in the audience?
This is before the actual show started, and the plan was to have, that's probably a few hundred people getting ready for the show to start. The actual, the gig was, there were about 500 or 600 people in the audience, everyone else was staff, and they were basically bussed from the big cities. Titans has these national fan clubs. And it was like an invitation-only sort of thing. Basically, explained to everybody, we're making a DVD, we need everybody to make noise. If anybody makes a mistake, we have to start the song over, you know, because the video footage can't have people breaking strings and so forth on it. The plan was to have it take place right as the sun was going down. So the show started at 5:30, ended at about 7, because this was summer in Seattle, but it's winter in Brazil. The nice thing about winter in Brazil is the weather's about the same as summer in Seattle. So I was right at home there. It was very nice. This whole stage, it was built from scratch with welders. There were people there welding. There were generators. You can see the porta potties up there. Back behind these trees were a bunch of generators. It was quite interesting. Grounding was a big issue. They spent hours and hours trying to remove buzzes and hums because, from what I can tell from being in Brazil, most everything isn't really very grounded. Like, you'll see that all the 3-prong plugs have had, they pull the 3rd prong out with pliers, you know. Similar to when I've been in Mexico, it's the same thing. Somehow, the thing that saved me is the band likes to use, they have 3 singers, 2 guitar players. They all use radio rigs, like pretty much like what I'm talking through right now. Which saved an enormous amount of problems. I was very skeptical of that, but they said, no, we jump around a lot, we'll trip over cables, we have to use the radio rigs. And in retrospect, thank goodness they did that, because I would have had a lot more buzzing and humming to deal with. They pulled a surprise on me. On the first, the plan was to do 2 shows, 2 consecutive shows, and tape them both. The first night, the MTV people said, "By the way, we're hiring a helicopter to take some photos." And I said, "Do you guys know how loud a helicopter is?" And because I had to record, this is another instance about, okay, aside from learning about DVDs the hard way, I had to record ambience because it's supposed to be live. Now, you'll notice it's an outdoor show. There's no reverb. There are no reflective surfaces. It's absolutely dry. So after, you know, I have audience mics out here, but basically the audience sounded very small and thin, and the claps just sounded like impulse response. I mean, they sounded like little clicking noises. It was a little better than that when things got going. But I wound up walking all over the place looking for some sort of source of ambience. And what I ended up was discovering this wall up here. I said, "Oh my goodness, there's my reflecting surface." You can't quite see it, but there is a boom stand right here on the grass with a mic pointing at the castle, catching reflections from behind the stage. And I ended up time shifting that and using a great deal of it in my mix for ambience. I also had a mic up here on this wall pointing down behind the stage, which wound up getting a lot of the audience and not so much of the band, because the band is pointed out that way, the audience is yelling in that direction. So I did manage to get some sort of ambience out of it, and when I was mixing, I had to sort of use artificial reverb, which felt sort of nasty, but it worked. The sound company, now I don't speak Portuguese very well, a little bit from being there so many times. The sound company that recorded the live stuff, and of course the video people had to send us time code, and I had to just cross my fingers and hope that everything was going to sync up later. The sound guy that they sent us was not their usual guy. We recorded the whole thing with Tascam hard drive 24-track machines. And safeties were made on DA88 linear tape. He was about to do the whole project on DOS-formatted drives, and I had to make a bunch of phone calls to people who could explain to him in Portuguese that, no, we needed Mac-formatted drives because this was all going to end up in Pro Tools. Solved that problem. Again, I had to hope that the time code was going to work. After the two shows took place, we took the files, I took the hard drives, and I plugged them into a Pro Tools system. We had 2 weeks at a Pro Tools LE studio. Now, and here was the next thing. Everything was recorded with time code at 29.97 frames per second, which is what the video people like to use. A Pro Tools LE system does not allow you the option of creating a Pro Tools session at a frame rate of 29.97, you have the option of 30, and maybe 25, I don't remember offhand. Anyway, I had to import all the files. The files all had timestamps, which was nice. I created Pro Tools sessions, dragged all my files into the session, they all snapped to the grid, but of course, there was some sort of offset, and I still to this day don't know what the offset was, because the sessions were hours long. Later on, when I was mixing, the MTV people gave me video of the whole show, and I was able to get the Pro Tools system synchronized with the videotape that they gave me that had time code on it, and somehow get it to sync up. And I ended up having to move my files. I ended up having to sync everything up the hard way, and you do that by taking the sound from the cameras and nudging your, well, I'm probably getting too geeky here, nudging my Pro Tools files until they matched the sound from the cameras, and it was a strange thing. Anyway, I'll show you a piece of the DVD actually, so you can see what the result is. I discovered one thing from mixing this, which was that nobody really knows what they're doing with 5.1. Everybody's making it up as they go, because there were two or three. There's a couple of other producers in Brazil who make like all the DVDs. And they both speak very good English, and they're friends of friends, and they were very nice to me. I could call them any time and go, you know, "Carlos, what do I do with this? You know, what do you put in the center channel?" And, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, I had the record company give me a bunch of live DVDs, and I just sat in my hotel watching them. And realize that everybody's doing it completely different. There's no rules, and some of them were great, some of them were terrible, and really I could do whatever the heck I wanted to with it. So let me see if we can get a DVD to work here. Okay.
Okay, you're safe now.
I think I'm going to stay out of the zone here. That was an interesting frequency. What was that, I wonder?
Time continuum.
Yeah. I think there's a force field here, and I can't step through it.
Cranked on DVD.
Yeah, let me see. I'll just show you a piece of it. I don't want to get all home movie on you here, but I'll show you a piece of the resulting thing.
And then I have to push something on this too to make this work, like video.
Yeah, how do you get the? There you go.
And then, theoretically, this thing plays. And
probably
need
a remote for it. Oh, you got it.
Yeah, still
no question how loud.
Okay, we're stealing this video, so come get us.
Public
Brazilian FBI.
Nah. Yeah. Yes. At least it's a region. It's a non-region DVD. It
yeah,
plays anywhere.
You. Thank you for that. Well, we forgot about one thing tonight. Okay, so...
Click on the top one if you can. Oh, you have, I can't step over there. You'll have to figure it out for yourself. Oh, and it's subtitled, I think. Not that there's...
Com vocês, a melhor banda de todos os tempos da última semana.
Just the volume.
É 15 minutos de fama, mais outros comerciais. 15 minutos de fama, depois distância mais. O gênio da última hora é o idiota do ano seguinte. O mais novo pedido. A melhor banda de todos os tempos da última semana. O melhor disco brasileiro de música americana. O melhor disco dos últimos anos e sucessos do passado.
Can you tell if anything's coming out of the rear speakers? There really isn't much in the rear speakers. There's a little bit of ambience.
Can anybody hear anything back there?
A little bit.
Yeah.
All right.
There's your ambience.
You'd have to wait till the audience made a lot of noise. Now this guy, whenever the audience got noisy or there was a sing-along, he would take his vocal mic and go like this with the audience. And that wound up being very important in the mixing. That's from the helicopter. Okay, you can. Now those aerial shots, they're from the helicopter, and of course, when the helicopter came, it completely obliterated the sound, and we had to go back and redo those songs again. But they got some nice footage out of it, at least. And I sort of got to say, I told you so, in Portuguese.
And how do you say that?
Yeah, let me think about that for a minute. Yeah, they spoke English.
Do
I
you
probably
want this
didn't
back?
Have to. You know, you might as well see when the sun went down, because the visual's amazing, and then we'll move on. Go to track 7.
Okay.
You want to
hear it, too?
Yeah.
Does the sun go down
slightly? Yeah. Here's where the video editing slows down a little bit, which is nice.
MTV people, they chop everything once per second. Except on the slow song.
Quando não houver saída, quando não houver mais solução, ainda de haver saída, nenhuma ideia vale uma vida. Quando não houver esperança, quando não restar nem ilusão, ainda de haver esperança.
Sometimes you see the lighting rig, which is behind him on the left side of the stage. You'll see this thing moving up. That's fine. Now let me tell you something. This, I don't think there's a live record in existence that does not require repairs. Okay? Meaning punch-ins, fixes, overdubs, fixing mistakes. Even though we had two complete shows to pick from, And I ended up flying guitar bits around between the two nights. Fortunately, the sound didn't change much. But you haven't lived until you've tried replacing a vocal in something like this, where the resulting vocal has to match the video footage. And I wound up spending hours and hours, because there were a couple of songs where people made mistakes on the lyrics. And there were a couple of new songs that they did that they just didn't, you know, they just didn't know them that well. And we had to re-record a few lines here and there. And A, I had to match the sound, which was doable, but I also had to match the video footage. And that meant I had to spend hours and hours with MTV's rough tape that they gave me of the video on a screen in front of me as I was hunched over a Pro Tools station. And I had to time stretch individual syllables and nudge things back and forth by maybe two or three samples at a time. And the thing I discovered was that you can really, even though video is what, 30 frames, whatever they were using, you can really tell if the audio is in sync with the lips, even if it's as little as 10 or 20 samples off. The difference is bizarre. It shouldn't be possible to tell that on that level of detail. But it was really obvious when something didn't quite line up. I would just nudge, and there it would be. So I spent an enormous amount of time matching things. We didn't really do that many vocals over again, literally just a few, some backing vocal harmonies, and a couple lines and some lead vocals, and it probably took me days.
What was your sample rate?
48. One other thing that saved my ass was something I thought ahead a little bit, and what I did is I recorded a DI signal from each of the guitars, and the reason this was useful is if I needed to combine. Now, no matter what you do, you've got amps with microphones on them. If the microphone moves a half an inch, the sound coming out of your Marshall guitar amp is going to be completely and totally different. And if you have to cut from one to another in the middle of a song, it'll be obvious. By using DIs from both guitars and from the bass, I was actually able to combine some performances from different nights by just combining the DI signal and then reamping it to a guitar amp, which I had them drag up to the studio, including the radio transmitter that they used initially, and I was able to create a new performance with a microphone, recorded back into Pro Tools, and use that. And it would be exactly synchronized with the original, but the point was I was able to create a new sound that was consistent from beginning to end, because, of course, the DI didn't change from night to night. The mic sounds changed. That was one of the weird things I had to deal with. Also, when we went to recut some of the vocals, I found out the hard way that I needed to get the wireless microphones that they were using into the studio to recut the vocals, because otherwise there was some sort of companding going on. Wireless rigs do this. There's some elaborate compression expansion thing going on with wireless microphones and wireless transmitters, and it should be transparent. It isn't. And I found that out quite quickly, that the tone I was getting was completely different without the wireless things. So I think I spent a total of like, it must have been 5-6 weeks on this thing after the day of the show, which just literally hunched over a Pro Tools station like 12 hours a day, because I had to mix it in stereo and I had to mix it in 5.1. Now, the deadline for the CD was weeks, maybe a month before the deadline for the DVD, so I had to do the whole thing in stereo first and have it mastered and deliver it and then go back to the studio and start mixing in 5.1. So while I was doing the 5.1 mixes, the first single from the record was already on Brazilian radio. That's another thing about Brazil, is they have instant gratification. You mix the record and it's on the radio a week later. Here in the United States, it seems to take 6 months. And the Brazilians, frankly, don't know why the record industry here, what they're spending their time doing. I guess greasing everybody's palm, I'm not sure. So anyway, that was what I did on my summer vacation of 2005. One of the stranger things that, you know, recording all these grunge bands led me to. Just for your amusement, I'll show you a picture of myself in Reciprocal Recording in 1988. Only thing is, you're going to have to change it off of the DVD.
Yeah, it should be coming up.
You think?
Searching.
Searching, searching.
I do that all my whole life, searching for something.
Nope. You're going to have to turn off the DVD, I bet.
Hey.
Hey, indeed.
Looks just like you.
Well, yeah, 1988. That was a Ramsa 20-channel board, and that down in the right corner is the Otari MX-5050 8-track machine that I did Bleach on. And I don't know, back in there, there's at least a Symmetrix, probably a 522 or something back there. turntable, we actually had a turntable in the studio. Good heavens. All right, anyway. So, yeah, it's been a lot of water under the bridge since that. Let me go through my thing here, because I don't know if I should get anecdotal or not. Because some of the strangest times I've had, I can tell you about recording in Mexico City. Wow. I can tell you about recording in Mexico City, which was something else I did for a band called Guillotina, which was, I think I did 3 albums for them. And the interesting thing about recording in Mexico City is the blackouts. You'll be in the middle of cutting a drum track and you'll suddenly be in pitch blackness, because randomly at any point during the day, the power can go out in Mexico City for anywhere from a minute to a half an hour to an hour or whatever. And it may come back on immediately and start frying your equipment, or it, you know, you may just have to go out, everyone has a cigarette, and they just kind of wait and they shrug and go, well, this is Mexico. More than once it would happen while I was in the middle of a drum take, and you'd be literally, you know how studios are, they have no windows. So you're in pitch blackness and everybody's fumbling for a lighter. The first thing they do is they dive for the circuit breaker panel and they kill all the circuit breakers, because Mexico City power is not too good, and when it comes back up, you can have big power surges. And you'd think they'd have Furman regulator things, but you know, you deal with what you have to deal with. Another studio I worked at in Mexico City was Blackface ADATs, and you know they have a little error light on them that's supposed to blink occasionally when you have, when the tape is, you know, when the heads are a little dirty. Well, picture the error light on solid the whole time you're making the record, like for weeks, and it still came out okay. In fact, you want a digital record, it was Blackface ADATs into a Yamaha 01V, which is their early digital board, straight to a DAT machine at 16-bit. But that was what I had to work with, and fortunately I was able to take it back to Seattle and master it and make it sound a little softer, and it came out great. But strange things. I went to Portugal once, and I was confronted with a studio that was in a small building in the corner of a junkyard, and there was a marble floor with no rugs, a perfectly rectangular parallel wall room was the control room with the marble floor and no rugs, and the first thing I did was demand that they bring me rugs. Everyone who had any sort of rugs, I need them now. And somehow I wound up mixing a record in that studio, but I did get to go to Lisbon for a month, which I would not have ever had a chance to do. there's been some strange ones. In 1995, I got a phone call from none other than Bruce Dickinson, who was the lead singer of Iron Maiden. At the time, he was not. He had left the band, and he was doing a solo career. And I thought, well, this is quite strange. If Rick Rubin can do... what was Rick Rubin doing? I said, if Rick Rubin can do AC/DC, well, I can do Bruce Dickinson. What the heck? And at one point, I found myself in a small plane with Bruce Dickinson. He owns a small plane. And that was another one of those, gee, what has, you know, punk rock got me here? How did, what am I doing here moments. That was a record that took months and months of incredible tedium, because they were literally writing the songs in the studio, something I don't recommend. Back to Seattle here. Seattle was having a grunge hangover around 96, 97. Nobody wanted to have anything to do with rock and roll. Guitars were sort of, you know, not good. We had rap rock on the radio. Britpop had happened and had already passed. Things were very slow here in Seattle. For a time, Tom Dyer down at the Art Institute was really like trying to get me to come and teach. And by the way, anyone know Tom Dyer? From the Tom Dyer was the guy who ran the recording program at the Art Institute until he moved away a few years ago. He's moving back here at the end of the month. If that means anything to anybody, I don't know. Okay. Aaron, how you doing? Let me go for some other things. There was one. I got to stop Mark Lanegan from throwing his tapes in a creek once. Mark Lanegan was the singer from the Screaming Trees. And I was working on his second solo album. I was one of, I think, five producers that ended up working on that record at some point. And he was literally so disgusted with the record, he didn't want to have anything to do with it anymore. He was sick and tired of it. And I was working out at Bear Creek Studio, which, of course, has a creek in the back of the studio. And he literally was about to take the tapes out and throw them in the creek, and I had to talk him out of doing it. And it's just, the record ended up coming out about a year later. I think Terry Date worked on it, I worked on it, Ed Brooks worked on it, a couple other people worked on it. And finally a guy out east ended up mixing it and pulling the whole thing together. Just going through my notes here. Oh, and in Moncton, New Brunswick, I was working with a band called Elevator, and the studio was in the basement of a strip club in Moncton, New Brunswick, which Moncton, New Brunswick is not very big. It's maybe the size that Bremerton was 20 years ago. But the studio owner, his brother owned the strip club, and he had all this basement space he wasn't using, so it's, oh yeah, put your studio down here. So we had to go in the strip club around past the bar and through a door behind the bar and down these stairs to get to the studio every day. It was quite amusing. The studio was actually not a bad place. And, gosh, the worst thing I got involved with was Titans in 2001. One of the band members actually was killed in a street accident on our first day of recording in Brazil. It was the previous record I did for that Brazilian band. And I wound up playing a lot of his guitar parts on the album because the band members were just, none of them wanted to touch it. They said, we can't, you know, they said, Jack, now's your time to play on a Titans record. And I knew all the parts because we'd been rehearsing for a while. That was one of the hardest records I've ever done. And, you know, this Titans thing leads me to something else. When I was mixing the Titans record that you just saw, I was in a studio with an SSL 9000J, which is a colossally huge, it's just a colossally huge mixing board. Let me see. Each channel has 92 buttons, 32 knobs, and 2 faders. There's 72 channels. So if you do the math, there's like literally thousands of buttons on these things. At any given time, and this was a relatively new SSL 9000J board, at any given time, a certain percentage, a very significant percentage of these buttons are intermittent. They basically go... Okay, this is true of every big old dinosaur mixing board I've ever worked on. Every Neve that I've ever seen in my life has got that snare drum that will drop out and disappear in the middle of your take. because the EQ button just decided to get intermittent at that exact moment, and you have to go, wait a minute, okay, it's back, or the insert button, or whatever it is. The SSL-9000J had more knobs and more buttons and faders than I've ever seen anywhere, and even the center master control section has over 250 buttons on it. And what I'm going to get at is I had an interesting sort of watershed moment while I was mixing the Titas record, and it was this. The first time I got in there to start the mixing, I brought all my drum tracks up, and I worked at it for probably a few hours using the EQ controls on the SSL mixing board. This is like a $500,000 mixing board. And I got the drum sounding as good as I could. So, okay, you know, we've got parametric here, and okay, a little bit of compression. Okay, let's, here it is, here's my drum sound. Okay, then I turned all of the EQs off on the board, and I went into Pro Tools, and I instantiated, as they say, EQ plugins on every channel of the drums, of which I think I had about 14 tracks, something like that, 14, 16 tracks. I was using the McDSP filter bank, which is my vote for the best EQ plugin on the Pro Tools platform. Your mileage may differ. And I spent a couple hours playing with this plugin, using the EQ inside the computer on the drums, and then I A-B'd them. And there was no comparison. The EQ plugins blew away the EQs on the SSL board, completely obliterated the sound. And I called the band and I said, well, here, what do you think? You know, and I ended up doing the rest of the record hardly using any of the EQ on the board. The reason this is a watershed moment for me is I see the future happening right now. And the future that I see is that automated mixing boards, flying faders, conventional board automation, which I used to see a lot of, where you have the whole mixing board acting like a player piano, it's going out the window. I think those boards, I'm afraid, and there may be people here who own SSLs, I'm sympathetic if you do, I think those boards may become very obsolete very fast because Pro Tools essentially is automation. I don't know how many of you students here have ever seen automated mixing. How much do you ever mess with that here, where actual faders are moving or any of that stuff, and you're like writing moves? And that's something that was very big years ago. But
we use control surfaces, but they're just MIDI controllers.
They're literally just following the moves that you've made in Pro Tools, or you're using them to write moves in Pro Tools.
Both.
Well, have you ever? Okay, you haven't lived until you've seen some of the old automation systems that were designed. NECAM automation, Otari Dismix, flying faders, and the system that SSL mixing boards have. I mean, some of these are DOS programs. I'm sure they're DOS programs or pre-DOS. I don't even want to think about how old some of them are. But if you're at all used to using a computer, a modern computer, you'll go nuts as soon as you're confronted with one of these linear automation systems, because for one thing, everything's in real time. You start the song, you write your moves, you go to the end of the song, rewind the tape or whatever you're using, write some more moves. Pro Tools is automation. It makes mixing boards with automation absolutely and totally obsolete. So I wound up mixing this entire Titas record, which was actually 28 songs, using this SSL 9000J board and never once turning the automation on. I literally used it as a giant summing bus. And I would take snapshots of the board. The automation has something called snapshots, which allows you to take a reading of exactly where all the knobs and switches are. And that was useful, because if I needed to go back and recall a song, I could do that. But basically, I never turned the automation on. I never had to use... There wasn't any business with synchronization. I would almost say that mixing boards themselves may be going out the window, because I recently mixed my very first record inside the box, which was something I've absolutely refused to do for years and years now. Most of the engineers I know, anyone who's really tried this, Pro Tools, of course, gives you the option of mixing entirely inside the computer. Assign everything to stereo 1 and 2, make some buses, insert, plug in your compressor plugins, whatever you're doing, to simulate the experience of mixing on a big mixing board. You can do that entirely in Pro Tools. And most engineers I know, myself included, sort of poo-poo that. Like, well, it's never going to sound as good as running it out through a big old Trident or, you know, an API or some big old analog board with nice, you know, electronics and headroom and so forth. And frankly, that's still true. It's probably going to sound better mixing through a board. My standard modus operandi for the last few years has been recording, sometimes analog, sometimes Pro Tools, but always mixing out through a big old analog mothership of a console. Right now, the studio where I work at the most has what's called a Trident 80B. It's a kind of a gritty, nasty, dark-sounding mixing board, but I've learned how to make it do what I want. Another studio I work at called ElectroKitty has got a Neve. And again, you have to play with the buttons that are scratchy and the pots that are intermittent, but when it works, it sounds glorious. But the plugins are coming along in the digital world. They're getting better and better at simulating analog compression, analog limiting, analog harmonic distortion, whatever the heck it is that we miss when we go to digital. The plugins are getting better and better at duplicating it. And so I see the future coming, and I'm not entirely afraid of it anymore. It took me long enough to get used to recording on ADATs and mixing to DAT machines. I'm glad that era has passed. I still use 2-inch all the time. I actually have 3 reels of 2-inch tape that I've been reusing for the last 3 years. Because I generally, if I really want the analog sound, I will do my tracking onto the 2-inch analog tape and then transfer it into Pro Tools and wipe the reels and start over. And from then on, the project lives inside the computer. And that's how I've been doing records now for a few years. And the reels, well, I'll keep using them until the oxide comes off them, probably. Let me see. What do I need to rant about? Because
related to that, have you ever retracked the digital and then put it, ran it through the analog tape and back into digital?
I've done it with individual tracks. Like, I've done it with kick drums and occasionally with snares and things. Like, if I specifically want the sound of just the smacking the levels and hitting analog tape so it kind of goes like that, I might do that. I generally, if I want that, I try and record to analog in the first place rather than going through A to D, D to A, analog tape, out of analog tape, A to D again. See what I mean?
Since you've already gotten the noise in the first, you know, since you want the extra distortion or noise or whatever it is from the analog tape, I just figured it might work.
It would. It's just you're literally introducing another step of A to D and D to A into the process, which the converters are getting better, but I would sort of try and avoid that if I could. I've always recorded at 15 IPS instead of 30 if I can get away with it. It's gritty and nasty, but I like the low end, and it does something very nice to electric guitars, which most of the bands I'm working with have electric guitars. But that's a matter of taste. I've been working on something for years. I call it Jack's Enemies of Civilization list. And, you know, it's a project that never actually is finished because it just kind of goes on and on. Like, for instance, whose idea was it to put plugins in Pro Tools or whatever with knobs on them?
Yes.
How do you interact with a knob on a screen using a mouse? My immediate urge is to take the mouse and go like this. Yeah. It doesn't work. You know, sometimes you move the mouse up and the knob will turn, or you move the mouse sideways and the knob will turn. I'm not sure of the ergonomics, the thinking that's going into that, but I note that the McDSP plugins that I like have all got sliders on them, which takes a little getting used to if you're used to knobs on a physical board, but once you're dealing with a mouse, it makes much more sense. Studios, there was one studio I worked at where the thermostat was mounted right over the tape machine. Now, if anyone can think about what that means, it means that when the tape machine is running, the studio is incredibly cold all the time. And as soon as you turn the tape machine off, the air conditioning turns off as well. But what can you do? Just going to run through some things here for you. C- Click tracks I've ranted about already. Your mileage may differ. I hate click tracks. Generally, the bands I'm working with are what you'd call an organic musical unit, where people are playing in real time. Somehow, in the late 70s, people got the idea that they needed to have perfect time in order to sound professional. And I just went through this with a band, actually, who had never played with click tracks before, but they had this idea that they really, really, really needed to play with click tracks. And, of course, they sounded incredibly terrible with the click tracks, because when you play with a click track and you're a drummer, you generally tend to speed up and slow down a little bit. If you are playing a song without a click track, you're playing in real time, everybody's interacting. Songs may breathe a little bit. A song may speed up or slow down a tiny bit. Generally, choruses or loud parts will speed up a little bit. Verses may slow down a little bit. The end of the song may be a little faster than the beginning. That is expression. Emotion is conveyed in those speed changes, just like you convey emotion with melody going up and down, loudness going up and down, music becoming more dense, timbre changing. All of this conveys emotion. Speeding up and slowing down also conveys emotion. This sort of thing didn't bother the classical musicians at all. Their classical stuff has all sorts of that things. If you take that away, you are literally removing one emotional dimension from the music. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it is people who play with click tracks, and this is assuming real drummers, not people who are sampled and looped. If you speed up from a click track, say you start at 90, your drummer speeds up a little bit to 91. He goes, oh, I'm ahead of the click now. Well, okay, he slows back down to 90 again, but now he's ahead of the click, if you think about that for a minute. So in order to get back on the click, he has to overcompensate in the other direction and play at 89 for a couple of bars to get back in sync with the click, because he speeds up, he goes ahead of the click. Then he's back to the same speed, but he's in sync with the click, but he's ahead of it, so he has to slow down again. So you get this very, very obvious push-pull thing where every time a drummer does a drum fill, you hear him slow down afterwards as he is like, oh, I'm ahead of the click, I have to pull back. And it's enough to drive you insane. And if you get stuck with it, you end up editing in Pro Tools for hours and hours and hours, and time slicing little bits, grouping the entire 14 drum mics, and slicing little pieces, little slices of, okay, there's a snare, there's a kick, nudging them, doing that sort of thing. And I don't recommend it to anybody as a form of amusement. So that would be one thing. Of course, I'm doing rock and roll bands, which if I was doing dance music, it would be a whole different issue.
Do you mean you would use a click if you make a dance music?
I think most dance music is not even made with real drummers. Yeah. You know, they're literally doing it by MIDI. I mean, there was a period when I don't think I've plugged in a MIDI cable more than once or twice in 20 years. That's the niche I'm in. There, people are literally just doing it in real time. But if you listen to commercial radio, rock and roll, per se, is a very, very, very small part of the popular music market. Popular music is largely R&B, hip-hop, ballads, and so forth, and it's all very, very manufactured music, and it basically has nothing to do with anything that I do in my career. And, you know, good luck to them. That's where the money is, actually.
What about, like, the Roots and hip-hop that has bands and stuff?
There aren't that many bands like that. There's a few. And you'd have to wonder how they do it in the studio, you know. I would bet that most of them are using clicks and using samples and using loops. And maybe the band is for live only. I could be wrong. It's not really my specialty. That's all right. That's fine. I had another good rant that was really bothering me. I'm so glad cassette decks are dead, by the way. Aren't you glad those are dead?
Oh, yeah.
You know, the nice thing about cassette decks is after like 2 or 3 years after you buy them, they speed up by like 1 or 2%. Now, 6% is 1/2 step, by the way. 1.06 is the ratio. This is 1.0594 is the ratio between half steps in the 12-tone musical scale. So if your cassette deck speeds up by 1%, that is 1/6 of a half step, or about 16 cents musically. And it's enough to have things be way, way out of tune. And does anyone have cassette deck alignment tapes? No, I bought one. I have a frequency counter and a cassette alignment tape with a 1K tone on it. It cost me $85 to buy this stinking cassette. And, you know, the frequency counter was another $250. But you can put it in the cassette, and there's a little set screw inside it, and you can adjust the speed. But and when we were working on the Nirvana box a couple years ago, which I wound up doing a lot of cassette transfers for the Nirvana box because we had a lot of stuff that was on cassette only, there was stuff from all over the place, and I really had to be careful about azimuth and so forth. Nobody knew this about cassettes. To this day, people are transferring cassettes without doing azimuth adjustments on them, without checking the speed, just because people just don't think of it. I'm just glad those are going away, and I'm so glad the DAP machines are going away. Don't even get me started with those. Here's a gripe. How about studios that spend $100,000 on a mixing board? They have Manly preamps. They've got, you know, beautiful gear, $5,000 microphones, but I can't find a ground lift anywhere. And I can't find a pencil sharpener, and there's only two working pairs of headphones. Or tools, like I want a screwdriver. Where's the screwdriver? Well, the tech's gone home. The tools are all locked up. I'm like, you know. I've had things like that happen. You know, I could go into a rant about mastering, because mastering has basically become, let's make our CD's average level be equal to the peak level. Think about that for a minute. It's impossible for the music's average level to be equal to the peak level unless it's literally like a square wave. And that is what more and more mastering, I'm afraid, is starting to look like. And I will show you some examples very quickly. I'm sure the professionals here know exactly what I'm talking about, but maybe the students haven't seen this. So what do we got here? This is actually... now, do we have audio right now?
Yes, sir.
Doesn't need to be too loud. I ripped these off of CDs and made Pro Tools sessions, and it's just a selection of just some random CDs I pulled out of my CD collection. The first one is Mudhoney's Super Fuzz Big Muff, which I recorded in 1987. And the CD came out around the same time. Frankly, CDs from the late 80s don't sound very good compared with CDs now, but they are not compressed quite as much. So that's basically... You don't want to turn it up too much. You'll see why. Okay. I don't remember what this next one is. No means no. From somewhere around the same, a couple years later. Here's a Marvin Gaye CD that I bought in the early 90s. Okay, Chemical Brothers from a couple years later. Rage Against the Machine from about 1994, I think. I'm trying to remember when the first Rage CD came out. Okay, and here's the Queens of the Stone Age Songs for the Deaf record. Here's Marvin Gaye. Ostensibly a dance record. Now, if we zoom in on the Queens of the Stone Age, you will see some interesting things. Like, for instance, you gotta wonder, what did it sound like before they mastered it? Like, here's a particularly loud section right here. Let's look at it. It gets worse. If you look carefully, now this screen is actually there's actually worse examples than this in the song, but I think you get the idea. The point of it is, imagine how much further up and down below the digital ceiling these would have been going. without, if it was not for the mastering. Most of those represent kick drums or other loud drum things. And now, if you have ears for it, you can actually hear the distortion that this is. It's like massive square waves. But because the high frequency content has been maybe rolled off a tiny bit, you don't hear it as a buzzy sound. It's just a general sort of... Anyway, so it kind of, it makes me very discouraged because here's a record I did by a band called the Black Halos. This was sent to a guy in L.A. who mastered it.
Friend of yours?
No, it was not a friend of mine. And, you know, the way he did it is quite clever because you can't really see obvious square waves too often.
Yeah.
Well, you can. But it's just, it came back insanely loud. It's all right. It actually has the, you know, it sounds like there is a kick drum there. But, it's a little discouraging. And I just got another CD back from someone that I mixed. They just sent me the CD, and somebody else mastered it. And now people are basically just mastering with... They pile a bunch of plugins on it and just hammer it. And the CD, I put it on my CD player, and it actually... I'd inadvertently left it a little bit turned up, and it actually hurt my ears. It came out suddenly just...
Oh, my God.
It's so loud, I had to dive for the volume knob and turn it down. Dynamics is basically going away, and it makes me very discouraged about what I'm doing as an engineer because, you know, you get it sounding right in the studio, and then somebody takes it and just throws it at the digital ceiling and just stomps all over it. So that's a pet peeve, but that just gives you some idea. And then, you know, this is like basically we're looking at like the last 15 years of mastering here in chronological order is what it amounts to. I don't really have a solution for that unless we suddenly go to 36-bit CDs, in which case I'm sure they will crank the volume level up even more. Now, I can tell you something about radio. People got into this idea because they thought that things need to sound better on the radio. Well, there's a catch to it. Radio is limited legally to a certain amount of power output that goes out over the airwaves. There's only so much modulation you can put on this carrier wave. And they have very elaborate systems in the radio stations that are basically massive brick wall compressors. And what they do is if something is too loud, it turns it down. If something is too quiet, it turns it up. That's why you tend to have everything come out of your car radio at the same volume. So if somebody makes a record like this thinking, well, we've got to make it louder for radio, all that happens is the processors in the radio station turn it down so you have something that's at the same volume it would have been initially, except now it has no dynamics. You follow me? So there's no rational reason for people to be mastering like this other than just to be louder than the Joneses, as it were. But I don't know. I still delve into mastering a little bit myself. I've done some of it, and the number one comment I always get back from people is, can you make it a little louder? It's not as loud as my System of a Down CD, you know, or whatever it is. So I don't advertise myself as a mastering engineer because it's just kind of demoralizing. You know, after I'm used to the mix, to just take it and do that with it and think, oh, well, why did I spend all that time mixing it? So, yeah, there's your fallacy of mixing for radio.
We're coming upon a break pretty soon.
Okay, let's go ahead.
Ready for that?
Do you need a break?
No,
need
it's
one.
Just the
I could use one. I'm completely scattered right now. And I have a couple of things I can show you, some Pro Tools tips and some things about mixing for stems that you've probably never thought about. That I can show you when we come back. Can we take a break?
Yep.
Good. Let's do it.
Let's do about 10 minutes, maybe?
Sure.
That clock is an hour off, by the way.
Yeah, that's true. Is that card at 10? Yeah. You just feel tired.
If you came in late, we want you to fill out a registration slip that we'll use to draw prizes at the end of the break. And also for you to tell us who you are and how we got to get hold of you if we need to.
Okay.